stock markets today are extremely volatile, even more so than in the past few years. In-depth investing with Gavin Graham helps to cut through the confusion. Gavin and his contributors, including expert analysts, journalists, advisors, and financial executives, can help. In each edition of this podcast, they cut to the core of the matter and suggest strategies to consider for selecting your investments and for keeping them safe and intact. And now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, and welcome to Investing in Depth with Gavin Graham. I'm Gavin Graham, and with my contributors in various areas around the world, I'll bring you investment analysis of the impact of global events, unfortunately many of them crises, on your investments and your financial health. You can be forgiven for listening to the investment news these days and feeling confused, or maybe that you should be retreating from the stock market and finding safety in less volatile investments such as cash or bonds, although the very low yields there make that less attractive. You could also be forgiven for wondering where the market and your investments are headed after hearing all the volatility that's out there as far as the political situation is concerned. Having been handling investors' money for over 35 years in half a dozen countries around the world, my own belief about the current investment climate is that while we are certainly seeing a slowdown, the question of whether it develops into a recession is uncertain at present. My first contributor will help us give some clarity on that. But in the meantime, we have the off-again, on-again trade dispute between the United States and China, slowing growth in countries such as China and the Eurozone, the turmoil in the Middle East, its impact on the price of oil, and the attractions of gold as a possible safe haven. Where this leaves you at the moment is that you've probably done fairly well with your investments over the last year or so. Most markets are up about 15 to 20% since the beginning of the year, and it's not a bad time to be taking some profits given that there is obviously an economic slowdown out there. So such interest rate sensitive sectors as utilities, REITs, and pipelines might look attractive, although they've already gone up quite a lot, as well as the bond market, even though bond yields have fallen quite substantially. To help you try to make sense of what's going on, I'm bringing in analysts, advisors, and journalists from various parts of the world. And one of the ongoing issues that is in the headlines at the moment is whether there's a recession coming. Some people point to the inversion of the yield curve, which is short-term interest rates being higher than long-term interest rates, and slowing economic indicators. But my first guest firmly believes we're not headed into recession in the short term, at least. He's here to outline his reasons. I have Paul DeSisto on the line from New York. He's Executive Vice President and Managing Director of M&R Capital Management, Inc. Thanks for coming in today, Paul.
Thank you, Gavin, for inviting me.
Not to worry. And I know that you feel fairly strongly that despite some of the negative indicators we're seeing, we're not heading into a recession. Why would that be?
I want to first say that your comment about the trade dispute being the problem or the concern of many people is spot on. That is an issue. Even today, they just had an announcement that looks like we're going to get a mini deal, if not a big deal. The market's up almost 400 points. But as for the recession, the yield curve inversion that you mentioned, while that has on occasion been predictive, but not always, when interest rates are this low across the board, it is unlikely that it's going to have the predictive ability that it's had in the past, because the TINA situation, there is no alternative situation, still exists. You're not getting any money in fixed income at all. The situation in other parts of the world, very, very slow growth, if not at all. Germany is in a recession, almost a recession. So the money is going to continue to flow into the United States. The domestic money is going to stay here, and the foreign money is going to come here. And that's going to continue to prop up our stock prices.
So if the inverted yield curve is not as a good an indicator as it used to be for the reason you state, which is the very low absolute level of interest rates, what other factors out there suggest to you that a recession is not coming anytime soon?
I get the feeling sometime when I hear the R word, some parties are referring to it as the R word, recession. It's almost a matter of wishful thinking by certain people in politics today. I do not really try to get sidetracked by the political situation. I really do look at the economics of it. I look at the earnings for companies and so forth. So that's much more significant than the situation with the politics and this projection of a recession. I just don't see it. Now, it is true that there might be some slowing down. The consensus earnings estimates for the fourth quarter went from $44 to $40, so the growth is slowing. And some of the numbers from the ISI indicate maybe 1.8 to 2% growth versus 3% growth. But I'm much more heartened by the fact that the jobs are plentiful. We had a surprisingly drop in first-time unemployment claims last week, and the jobs are plentiful. Consumers 65 to 70% of the economy, and they're going to keep spending money. And as long as that continues and the job situation stays the way it is, then we should be fine, recession-wise.
That's obviously a very important point. As you say, the consumer is somewhere around two-thirds or even more of the economy. And what with employment at a 60-year high and unemployment back to levels we haven't seen since, early mid-70s, it does seem as though that should be a major support for the economy and hopefully the stock market indices.
Indeed, I agree.
So the other side of things, of course, is capital spending. And one of the criticisms of this recovery has been that corporations have been very unwilling to actually put money back into new equipment, preferring to do stock buybacks or dividends or M&A. Is that a major concern longer term for things like slow productivity growth and the fact that without investment in capital, maybe there won't be as good employment prospects going forward?
That is always a concern when there's a lack of capital investment. I don't think it's going to be quite the concern that people make it out to be because of the situation of productivity that you mentioned. While it's indeed it has slowed down a bit, much of it is simply due to the fact that wages have gone up quite well in the last year for workers. And when you have wages go up that much, that does decrease your productivity in and of itself. So whether that slowdown in productivity growth is due to lack of capital spending or increased employment, it's kind of hard to determine which is which. So I wouldn't worry too much about it, but I would always keep my eye on that. It could be a factor if it continues to stay slow.
And what is the major risk to you, this somewhat more optimistic assessment in terms of how the economy is doing from left field? For example, if there were to be a breakdown in trade relations and even more tariffs between the US and China, or if there were to be, say, another flare-up in the Middle East and the price of oil suddenly is rocketed, would those type of geopolitical things be something that could derail this relatively beneficial outlook?
It certainly can derail it, but those type of events tend to be ephemeral in nature. And we have flare-ups or periodic concerns about war in the Middle East or in the Korean Peninsula periodically, and it looks bad for a day or two, and then it goes away. So it does cause volatility. The volatility is good, particularly if you're a trader, particularly if you're doing a lot of options work and so forth and things like that. So some people love to have that volatility. But those type of geopolitical events or endogenous events, they tend to be only temporary in nature. The important thing is the things that we discussed earlier, which is the earnings, the employment situation, and of course, what interest rates do. We haven't mentioned that. But the latest today was the Dallas Fed president thinking that perhaps we should have one more drop in interest rates, and they are meeting at the end of the month, and we might see another 25 basis points. So I think the Fed is prepared to take corrective action if we do have a slowdown because of the other reasons that we discussed.
So just to summarize things here, Paul, then, assuming that fall in interest rates continues and the economy continues to be relatively steady, which sectors would you recommend for investors looking here?
I still think you should look at the tech sector because it just for reasons of simply economic growth there. It is where things are taking place. It's where things are happening. I am no fan of the banks right now because I think the interest rate spreads continues to be a problem. I think the issue with healthcare, as long as there are political considerations about controls on prices of healthcare, that's a concern as well. I still like utilities, even though they've run up, because you're going to get your 3 to 5% yield on that, and the possibility of some growth, which you're not going to get with fixed income securities. So it's kind of a mixed bag there. The market overall is going to continue to go up, but those sectors I think are very good. One industry in particular I like is medical equipment, as opposed to pharmaceuticals and as opposed to medical insurance. I think it's being overlooked. Medical equipment companies like Danaher and Medtronic and Stryker, which are doing really well despite the noise regarding drug prices and so forth.
Yeah, I think certainly medical equipment is something that you can justify in whatever scenario because it helps save costs. That's a very useful roundup, Paul, and some interesting suggestions as to where people might look in the present circumstances. Thanks very much indeed, and I'm sure we'll be chatting again soon.
Thank you, Gavin.
Cheers. So that was Paul DeSisto, Executive Vice President and Managing Director at M&R Capital in New York. And as he mentioned, utilities, medical equipment, and he still likes technology, which is a sector which obviously has been one of the big leaders over the last few years, and certainly in terms of valuation maybe looking a little extended, but his point about that's where the growth is coming from is a very valid area. Now, moving on from the bigger macro picture, let's look at a particular sector. Everyone likes to save money on costs wherever possible, and saving on investment expenses is no exception. Brokerage houses have fought price wars for many years. These wars have recently gone into overdrive. Charles Schwab led off by removing trading commissions on stocks and ETFs, followed by its rivals like E-Trade Financial, Interactive, and TD Ameritrade. Fidelity, which is widely viewed as a holdout, has followed suit in the last couple of days. The sudden cuts got everyone, investors, traders, and analysts by surprise. For investors, it sounds like a dream come true, but it may be a bit of a mixed blessing. Here to discuss this, I have Rich Guler on the line from Boston, where he's president of Argyle Investment Consulting. Thanks very much for coming on to speak with us about this, Rich.
Yes, yes. Good morning, Gavin. It's a nice day to watch the futures rally, and it's probably a bleak day if you're trying to figure out how to make ends meet at one of those impoverished brokerage firms.
Well, impoverished brokers sounds a little bit like a contradiction in terms, Rich. Having said that, how on earth are they justifying not charging for commissions? I know we've come down to a really low level and you're paying $4.99 or in some cases $1.99, but nothing at all. How are they going to make money?
Well, it's interesting. Firms have different product mixes, although they have significant parts of what we remember in the early days when Schwab was first invented and Muriel Siebert, you might recall, was yes. One of the leaders who's long passed away. And the more diversified your business is, the less impact there is, although this is a lightning rod for publicity. Ally Financial, for example, has barely been dented in terms of its stock price, but it's a minor player. Schwab obviously announced, and E-Trade and TD Ameritrade, their major competitors, took real bloodbath drops in their stocks, you know, down 20, 25 to 30% overnight. The firms look to me as if they've been making money if they have bulk of accounts and assets sort of under the umbrella of the firm by selling the order flow to other brokers. Retail brokers, according to a Reuters article that's on the web right now, it's only 2 days old, very quite good, in fact, says that the mom and pop investor is about 20% of the activity on the New York Stock Exchange, et cetera, right now. The number of over $100 stocks is quite large, and in our lifetime, which if we added together would be over a century, I think, in the market.
I think so. Yes.
$100 stocks always split because they want participation, but that's not true anymore. These firms run ETFs and funnel the assets there eventually, but generally speaking, they're willing to go to zero in this commission pot, if you will, because they expect to make it up, as we used to say, make it up in volume elsewhere. And whether they're going to be successful or not, this business is shaking out. One of the things that it's very peculiar, no one's talking about the fact that if you gather in the primary culprits here, beginning with Schwab, their stocks have been in bear markets now for quite a long time. They've underperformed the marketplace, and by any measure, they have true bear market characteristics. This looks like late cycle jockeying to sort of create the bottom in the business and reconstitute it to the degree that the stock price would be important to the board of directors, et cetera. But there's no mention about that in any of the articles.
No, that's true enough. And certainly, as you say, the Schwab, E-Trade, and TD Ameritrade are all off 25-30% over the last year. Although, to be fair, a lot of that happened with the Schwab announcement in the last couple of weeks. Interestingly, though, Rich, they are actually up somewhat over 5 years, presumably because, as you say, it's market share and the big guys are getting bigger. But let's assume that they do make it up on volume by order flow or whatever, and presumably also by gathering assets and getting a fee for the interest balances and the rest of it. Why are they feeling the need to do it now? Is it these new entrants that are actually starting to make a dent in their market share?
I think it is. I think that just, you know, I don't want to be a pain, but as a, having gone into meetings and not looked at the chart and made a statement and then regretted that many times during my lengthy career, to give you some context, TD E-Trade traded around $65 a share in the middle of 2018, and it's now at 40.
Right.
And so the recent drop was after it had taken a very, very bad drop at the end of 2018. So something in the mix, I have a feeling it's a regulatory issue too. I think that their administrative costs are much higher. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're now chasing the sort of Vanguard led low fees equal better performance overall mantra. And the big kahuna is Interactive Brokers. It's that fellow who is highly creative and runs a great shop. And I'll mispronounce his last name, but I've always thought they were in Chicago, and they're in Greenwich, Connecticut. So that's always been a place where some of the big the sort of trading shops have been, not in New York City. But anyway, They're presenting that challenge, and so Interactive Brokers on one side, and they pay much higher on cash balances there.
You're
and
right,
lower margin.
Do, yeah.
And Fidelity's on the other end with the largest number of accounts, and these guys are now in between and been drawn into the wealth management business, which is where they think they can make up the losses of the commission business. They all want to be, they're all running after that 500,000 to 1.5 million / millennial trading / investment account, and they would, yep. And they make their money, I think, inside the balances, the order flow, according to the Reuters article. But I know from my own experience that the ETF business has been booming, et cetera, inside of all these shops. And TD Ameritrade especially has invested a lot of money in something called Think or Swim, which is a very good platform that allows you to trade. The consequence of all this may be that these folks learn to trade late in the market cycle and then don't do so well for free when everything gets a little bit more complicated, which is likely to happen.
No, indeed. And as you say, Rich, it's there's pressures coming from all sides. Thank you very much. That's a very interesting dive into the reasons behind what at first sight looks like a counterproductive move. Thank you very much indeed. And I'm sure we'll be speaking again in the not too distant future.
All right, Gavin, and don't forget those Argentine banks down there at $3.
Certainly, that would be a contrarian call. Thanks so much, Rich.
Okay, bye-bye. Yes.
Bye. So as Rich was saying, the major players in the discount brokerage sector are all down fairly substantially over the last year to 18 months, with a big dive at the end of last year. And obviously, getting rid of commissions, trading commissions completely, is a fairly major response. So now let's move on to another hard-fought battle, which is likely to be the one where we see entertainment, because it's one of the things that people are doing more and more in your homes. And the battle for the consumer dollar is one of the one that's being most actively contested. The name we most of us recognize here is Netflix, which until recently seemed to have a hammerlock on streaming. But while investors loved it then, that's now changing. Here to discuss some of these developments, I have Hollywood correspondent and author Shari Williams on the line. Shari, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Netflix.
Yes, absolutely.
Again, one thing that would be clear is Netflix may have lost some of its high-flying status. The stock is off, actually, down over the last year by about 11%, even though it's still obviously up a lot, over 400% over the last 5 years. Taken quite a lot of flack for increased competition, would that be fair to say?
Oh, yes, quite. Netflix lost about 126,000 subscribers in the United States when they raised their rates by about 13 to 18%. They do this about every 18 months just to cover the borrowed money they spend on major Hollywood talent and lavish promotional events. Subscribers have also left because there's been no new episodes of its original hit series, particularly The Crown. Luckily, season 3 of Stranger Things started last summer.
Indeed, and I understand that season 3 of The Crown is due to arrive with Olivia Colman at some stage in the next few months. Mm-hmm. But while that's been the loss of existing subscribers, the influx of new subscribers was also disappointing, I believe.
Yes, even though they did add 2.7 million subscribers, investors were expecting 5 million. However, the good news is they hope to add more than 7 million subscribers now that the new season of Stranger Things has started.
Does that appear to be a reasonable target?
Well, they think so. They're still the nation's largest internet television subscriber. They have over 60 million paying subscribers in the United States alone.
So even though they had that very large paying base in the United States, and similar with a lot of other consumer products, a lot of analysts feel that some of Netflix future growth will come from emerging and frontier markets. Could you explain that for us?
Sure. Globally, Netflix has more than 151 million subscribers. With its future growth seems to be coming largely outside the United States. In fact, India represents its best opportunity since Chinese markets have had a lot of regulation problems.
So here at home, is it fair to say that while they originally had a monopoly on streaming, they're losing it now?
Well, streaming television is about to become a battlefield for subscribers, as you know. Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus launched this fall, followed by HBO Max and NBC next spring, with Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu already generating a ton of programming. It's sketchy how many streaming services the American market can sustain. So they're all hoping that bringing back nostalgic old characters and brands will help bring back subscribers.
And what's Netflix doing on to hold on to its subscribers?
Well, what differentiates Netflix from entertainment alternatives? Exclusive content. And if they give members access to $3.99 short-term rentals of new and old films, imagine how that could go with such a huge established audience. I mean, really, Netflix can pay more money than anybody else in the market because of its scale. It may have lost out on some valuable content, but it also has the means to replace it. In fact, the recent content deal with Game of Thrones is a very savvy move, but it should be just the beginning.
Well, Sherry, that's extremely interesting, and it looks as though Netflix does have some arrows in its quivers, to use a Game of Friends reference, to help fight off the competition. Thanks very much indeed, and I'm sure we'll be back to talk because the entertainment area is a major, major investment sector. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Talk to you.
So that was Sherry Williams from Hollywood talking about how Netflix is fighting back against some of its challenges. And interestingly, looking at the stock performance, as I mentioned, Netflix is actually amongst the worst performing of the entertainment companies over the last year. It's off 11%, whereas Comcast is up 30%, AT&T and Disney are up 18% and 17%, even Apple's up 8%. However, longer term, as mentioned, with a 450% rise over 5 years, Netflix still way outperforms even Apple at 135%, while the others are up maybe 50 to 70%. So finishing up here, we've touched on the macro outlook for recession. We've touched on competition in the discount brokerage market and in the entertainment market. Where might one look to put one's money? We've had suggestions that perhaps interest rate sensitive stocks and even bonds for that matter are a good area to look at in an era of falling interest rates, with the Fed likely to cut rates a couple of times. Another asset class that looks interesting is gold. While it produces no income in this era of very low interest rates, that's much less of a negative. A strong dollar, such as we've seen for the last few years, is supposedly bad for gold, but actually gold has been rising while the dollar's been strong. And in the meantime, the negative sentiment towards precious metals means that shares in gold miners are almost their cheapest relative to the metal in the last 25 years, which has seen a rash of mergers, including Newmont's takeover of Goldcorp and Randgold and Barrick, as some managements feel that it's worthwhile buying now, because while gold may not move ahead into a prolonged bull market, although back to its all-time high at $1,850 US an ounce is only 25% of where it is now. If you're growing your production, even with the present gold price, you can still deliver very decent returns. Amongst gold miners, a royalty company, Franco-Nevada, for example, is up 58% in the last year and has more than doubled over the last 5 years. Gold miner Agnico is up 60% over the last year and 128% over the last 5 years, and Pan American Silver, while only up 14% in the last year, partially due to a major acquisition, which has led to some overhang in the stock, is still up almost 82% over the last 5 years. And in all of these stocks, unlike the metal itself, you're actually getting a yield around 0.81%. So you might want to look at gold mining stocks as a means of diversifying your portfolio, because it's not generally correlated with a lot of other things, and it does look as though the price of gold is now looking more attractive in a falling interest rate environment. On that note, let me remind you to check with your financial advisor, perhaps even your tax advisor, about all the investment decisions as their viability and suitability for your own situation. This wraps up this edition of Investing in Depth with Gavin Graham. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. You'll soon be able to find the printed edition of this program on Amazon, whether via podcast or printed version, or even both. We hope you find our information useful. Thank you very much for listening in, and we'll be back soon with more useful information on the investing scene. Thanks very much indeed, and it's been a pleasure to speak to all our guests today.
Thanks for listening to this edition of In-Depth Investing with Gavin Graham. Be sure to check out the book version of this podcast on Amazon. And please join us again for more in-depth investing.